Welcome back to Between Takes with Opal Entertainment. I'm Aiden Driscoll.
And I'm Olivia O'Neill. And this week, we are going to be talking about one of my favorite books of all time with our guest, David Driscoll.
Yeah, we're going to talk about C.S. Lewis and specifically his novel, Till We Have Faces.
So if you've not read this book already, there will be major spoilers in this episode.
And if you haven't read this book and don't plan on it, here's a quick crash course on Till We Have Faces this week on Between Takes. Cool. All right, we're rolling. Are you rolling?
I'm rolling. Rocking and.
Rock on. Like JK?
All right,
I'm going to close that because I don't have any. Cool.
Sergey.
Sergey. Instead of saying, because for a while I would just go rock on, and then I go rock on and off. Sergey, rock on and off. So now I just say Sergey when I mean rock on and off.
Okay.
That's my new thing. Yeah. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Thank you. It's good to be back, even if I'm actually in the same place and you're there in Nashville.
Right.
Yeah, this is the first time trying this where we're having a guest over Zoom.
The closest Dave pointed out before we started when we called Chuck that one time.
That's
true.
He was
on the first like 90 seconds of that episode.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I still think you should have a, what's Chuck think? Daily phone call every episode. I think that would be fun.
Oh, that's a great idea.
A weekly segment.
We just call him up segment. And see what he's up to.
I like that idea.
David Letterman used to do that from, he's in New York, and there was some skyscraper you could see just across. And so somehow he randomly got the phone number of someone in some apartment over there and called. Hmm. And it was a regular segment that he talked to this woman, random lady over in this apartment in New York. It was
the same woman every time?
Yeah, I don't know how often it was, but that's every so fun. Often it was fun. He used to be fun, but
that was back when.
But then he got important and other things. But.
Well, at least he got out before there were 9,000 late night shows every night of the week.
Yes.
And here we are. Okay, well,
should we jump right in?
Yeah.
What are we talking about today?
We are talking about Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis. Dave, you've read Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis.
I have read Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis.
And Liv, this was like one of your top few favorite books.
And you just listened to it over the last couple days.
Yes, over the last couple of days. I listened to it in a day and a half. It was a good time.
Yes.
What prompted you to listen to it in a day and a half?
I had a day and a half. No. I don't remember. I was like, I have all these books that I have saved on Audible. And I think I was just tired. I finished The Inner Tube, which is the podcast I've been listening to for the past several months. And I had started it over because it's like really entertaining. I really enjoy it. But I think I was like, I just want to try something new. So I just went through my Audible library and I was like, oh, Till We Have Faces. I haven't read that yet. And that was, many C.S. Lewis books I still haven't read. So I started it, and like 6 hours later, I was almost done with it. But work was over, so I had to I had to be done for the day. So I just listened to it over the last couple of days, and
you didn't tell me about until you had almost. You were like, "Oh, I'm started Till We Have Faces," and
morning.
I was like, "Oh, wow!"
Yeah.
And then you were like, "I'm almost done with the book."
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's so well written. It's so good. Liv,
so
what do you like
going
about
on.
It?
I mean, I guess for C.S. Lewis, this is to me a different tone than I had read for him because it was such like a fictional setting, and then a world that could be somewhat conceivably like real, which like Narnia books and stuff you kind of get, but that's a little bit more fantastic, like whatever. This is more of like. You're going to this world that's like real and stuff. I think it's also super interesting how it's a girl that he's like the main person. And we were actually talking about this earlier about like how well he's writing
from a woman's perspective.
Yeah. It's so crazy, but you can also kind of understand. I mean, she has, I guess, I don't know. She's a complex character. I think it follows kind of that her, as one person, and I like books like that too, where it kind of follows them and their interactions with the people and a whole narrative. I also don't understand it. And that also is intriguing because I don't quite know what what it's saying yet. So I'm really excited to talk about this because I want to hear your guys' perspectives of it because it's so intriguing, but for what reason, I don't know.
Right.
When did you read it?
I honestly don't really know. I think I was probably 14 or 15, something like that. And then I reread it a couple years ago. And then, honestly, I just got another copy because I was hoping to read it before we did this, but I didn't. It just came today, so. But I'm gonna try and read it again.
Yeah, next episode, Liv will have a follow up.
Yeah, have some
more fresh take on it. So, Dave, without spoiling too much of the actual plot of the story, what
are we not wanting to spoil?
Well, not yet. I think we'll get into that later. But just like, if you're trying to pitch this to someone. What are the things that stick out to you that you think are really cool about this book?
Well, I think I'll start with what Olivia said, that I don't get it. And some of the most important stuff to me is stuff I don't get. I would say the Oh Hellos fits that. There's a lot in the Oh Hellos that it's like, I mean, on one level I get it, but there's a lot in it that there's something more going on. And what did that line mean? Did that mean this or that or the other thing? There's a lot of that in the Oh Hellos, and there's a lot in this in understanding what's going on. It's radically different than anything else he's written, in my opinion. You know, Chronicles of Narnia are their own, you know, they're obviously children's stories. The Space Trilogy, the three novels that are that, are...
Those aren't children's stories, are they?
No, not at all. And they're really important to me, but they're really important to me for philosophical reasons or theological reasons, not for their art. His skill as a fiction writer has grown on me over the years, but when I first read them, I thought they were fairly poorly written as fiction. They're important books, but they're not great fiction. You know, and his other stuff that might be fictional, like The Great Divorce of the Screwtape Letters, the polemics in it, the points he's making are far more important than the fiction. So even if it's good as fiction, you kind of don't notice. I mean, he is actually kind of good. Screwtape Letters is a not a bad piece of fiction, but it doesn't feel like fiction. It feels like a book of theology to me.
Yeah, you feel like you're reading it to gain a sort of knowledge.
Yes, that's exactly how I feel. I don't read it like I do other fiction books. Until We Have Faces is the only book of his that I would say I read as... I read Dostoevsky or Flannery O'Connor, you know, as someone who's just a novelist. Mm. So it's really different in that way. I agree with you that it's, you know, some have accused him of being, you know, he's just an old bachelor. He's all about men. He's, you know, he doesn't understand women. He's kind of a sexist or whatever. And I think
who said that?
Till we have lot. Really? People I've had discussions with over time, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like he has some pretty outstanding women characters.
I agree. And, you know, Jane Stoddock is the main character in That Hideous Strength, and Lucy is the main character in, so he has great women characters, and I agree that Oriol and Psyche are, and even Redival, third sister, you know, he's really good at, and I think partly, I don't know, there are several different things. Partly, he's good because a woman is a person. And I think a lot of people who want to write about men or about women, write about women or about men rather than people. Mm-hmm. And Oriol is first and foremost an individual.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, so the reality of this individual who happens to be a woman comes through.
Yeah, he's not just writing stereotypes of, if one could write a stereotype of like the sister that is kind of like annoying and like what Redival, like not necessarily annoying, but she's over the top and kind of whatever.
Right.
And you could write that stereotype, but he didn't start there. He started with kind of what Dave was saying was like the person and then she had these like... characteristics or whatever that may fit a stereotype, but that wasn't where he started. So,
So I think if I had read... C.S. Lewis has been C.S. Lewis, like, for so long, and pretty much my entire life. I remember reading The Lion, Witch, and the War. I remember reading, like, the first couple books of The Chronicles of Narnia and being like, oh, these are really good books. But pretty much after that, he's been C.S. Lewis, this giant figure in Christian literature and theology. And... You know what I mean? So it's one of those, like,
yeah.
It's hard to separate his reputation from his work in a way. When I read The Great Divorce for the first time a couple of years ago, I remember thinking, because I think the last new Lewis book I had read was probably, I guess I had read snippets of Mere Christianity a year or two earlier, but I haven't read an entire, like, new Lewis book for a while. Mm-hmm. And so when I read The Great Divorce... I remember thinking, like, oh, wow, this is so familiar. His writing style is so distinct. But it was really interesting because most of what I knew, known, that's with that two syllables, up to that point was Narnia and the Screwtape Letters, and that was about it. Mm-hmm. And then I read The Great Divorce, which is very different. You know what I mean? Because Language in the Wardrobe is very, like you said, like children's, like fairy tale stuff. Screwtape Letters is kind of like tongue-in-cheek theology. You know, it's very dry and... ironic because it's telling you it's like exploring the nature of sin not from a virtuous perspective. It's exploring the nature of sin where sin is virtuous in and of itself. So I like seeing those which are like distinct from each other, and then The Great Divorce was like the same style but a very different tone. And so I guess I say all that to say, like, if I had read Till We Have Faces and not known it was C.S. Lewis, I would have I don't want to say this to as a detriment to him. But if it had been some random author I'd never heard of and I'd read Till We Have Faces, I would have thought, like, this is one of the greatest books I've read.
Because really? One of the greatest books you've ever read?
Well, I think, again, just because it's C.S. Lewis, I have hesitation because I'm like, I already have these years and years of opinions on some of his other stuff that within the category of C.S. Lewis, it's going to take some time and thinking about and rereading to figure out where it goes. But yes, reading Till We Have Faces the first time, it just like grabbed onto me in a way that very few books have from the very beginning. And also, most of the books I have read have been read to me. You and Mom have found decided to read those books to us. So a lot of it belonged to there was a larger context than just the book itself and my relationship to it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It was while we were reading, while Mom was reading Peter Pan to us when I was like 10, we were also talking about Peter Pan. There was just context around it. Whereas there haven't been, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is probably the first book that I actually read on my own and had my own opinions on and thoughts on and kind of relationship with before it belonged to any larger discussion. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess that's the thing too, is like there's you reading the work, there's your relationship with the author, there's the context in which you were introduced to it and all that. So I guess, yes, Till We Have Faces is definitely one of the most unique reading experiences I've had with a book. That's kind of a long-winded, not really, I don't know.
No,
I don't know
it's
how
interesting.
Grounded that is. But yeah.
Because it's C.S. Lewis, you're like, what is the meaning? What's the message
the
here?
Thing.
What are we trying to discover?
Well, okay, I want to go back a little
bit. I think there is
bit.
Something, because he's him. Like, that's how writers hopefully write, is like, what are we saying? But I don't know.
Yeah. And so that is where I think we're going to find some gray area between the three of us, because, okay, I'm not, how do I say this? So you think the point of most of Lewis's work is what is the point of his work? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
You think the point of That Hideous Strength is he's giving a very accurate representation of how humans work within government and politics and their own theology.
Yes,
and,
he says that.
Right. And you think the Screwtape...
He says that of the book, so I believe him.
Okay. That's so
he says, so I'll just jump in there. I would say that C.S. Lewis is one of the half dozen at the largest number most influential people in my life in terms of having created the basis or the foundation for how I view the world. Now, I didn't discover him until college. So, you know, to have him actually fit in with the foundation of what I think from when I was 4 and 9 is significant. So there isn't any other writer that fits that category for me. There's there is no subject for me that I can think of that maybe sports where, you know, talking about it or thinking about it, C.S. Lewis doesn't play a role in how I think about it. Far and away, the most important book for me by C.S. Lewis is The Abolition of Man, which is a harder book for most people, and it's not one that a lot of people read, but it's...
That's not fiction, is it?
No. It describes specifically educational system, but the culture system, and the things that he says in 1941 when he wrote it, he says are going to happen in education. You know, they have come to fruition, and then some. I mean, he absolutely predicted how things would go. He says in the introduction to That Hideous Strength, the third novel of the science fiction series, he says this is playing out things that I've written in another book, The Abolition of Man. So this is a fictional representation of the ideas that he's putting forward in The Abolition of Man. And those ideas are fundamentally, I guess what I'd say we have seen explode the world in the last 6 or 7 years.
Right.
The absolute destruction of civilized culture is exactly what the plan to do it, to undermine, the plan to undermine civilization is what those are about and how to do it. And it's done through exactly the thoughts that The Abolition of Man outlines. So, yes, I think he is. I don't think the Screwtape Letters, I mean, I'm rethinking as you're saying it. Screwtape Letters is better fiction than I have thought of it as. But it's so much better theology.
Right. It's not like he's creating. It's not about the world building. It's not about connecting with the characters. It's about him creating a fictional couple of characters that are conversing about these things.
But if he just had that conversation without those characters, I don't know if the book would be as grabbing.
I don't think it would. Yes. I think giving it. I mean, I think it's the same reason that. What's an example? Godspell is.
Right.
Is so intriguing, is so cool, because it's not just, hey, let's retell the story of the gospel, or even let's make the gospel a musical. It's let's put the gospel in a brand new framework and tell a story that way.
And he does that a lot, Lewis. He has a lot of, in, for instance, Religion and Science, which is a collection of his essays that have been published in various places. It's the first book, actually, I read. I'd never heard of him, and someone told me to read one specific essay. Why is that funny?
I don't know. Just because I think so. C.S. Lewis. Oh, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Screwtape Letters. Mere Christianity.
No, I'd never heard of
like,
them.
I just think that's so funny because in like
religion and
our family growing up and all the people we knew, it's like C.S. Lewis. Oh, yeah, we all know C.S. Lewis for these works. And then way on the back is God in the Dock and Religion and Science. You know what I mean? Those are the ones that are kind of the back burner C.S. Lewis.
That was my introduction to him was God on the Dock, and specifically the essay Religion and Science. So I'd never heard of him, and I read this one essay that was 2 or 3 pages long, and then I read the rest of the book. But it transformed me. It transformed how to put things together in a total package, intellectually and culturally. I forgot why I was saying that. Sorry.
I don't know. That's fine. Well, okay, so I kind of bring that up to say our family, and talked with Liv in other areas, have a certain disdain for work that presents itself as art, and the point of it is the underlying message. But you know what I mean? We have a certain... When we start watching a movie and 10 minutes in, we go, the only thing they're doing is pushing this agenda. Whether we agree with it or not, you know, that's a thing that I think I can watch a movie and go, oh, they're pushing this agenda I don't agree with. Or here's this Christian movie where I agree with what they're trying to say, but it's poor quality and that's all they're trying to do. So what's the distinction between that and what C.S. Lewis does?
Good question. Excellent question. And I think there is one. And I think we've come up to what it is until we have faces. Till we have faces, Olivia says... She doesn't get what it's about. I say the same thing. And I know what the Screwtape Letters is about. So he's up front, and I think that's the difference. He's telling us that he's teaching us lessons. In the Chronicles of Narnia, we don't have that sense that he's teaching us lessons. People have have seen allegories and things like that there, but he's, Lewis has been adamant about what it is and what it isn't, and it's a fairy tale, it's fiction, it's not polemical.
He has said within his own fiction that it's kind of impossible for his own ideology and faith and philosophy to be excluded entirely from it.
Well, and more than that, he has said, and others have said, it's impossible for anyone to tell a story. Mm-hmm. No one can tell a story without a Christ figure in it. You can't do it. It's not possible.
Oh, sorry. Well, I was just going to say, in music that we write, we're not necessarily like saying for a particular song, let's do this. I mean, whatever. But I don't know. Like, your character comes through whatever you're creating. So if you're close to God with, hopefully that would, I mean, that would be the hope.
Right. So like the Solon Man that we wrote started as just, what if we created this personification of that sinking feeling of, I don't want to do anything with my life or today I'm bummed out, you know? Mm-hmm. And from that, it started there. And from there it evolved to this giant idea of like how dangerous that is to cut yourself off and exclude yourself from the world and your community. Which we then kind of counteract with a significant portion of the rest of the album that is get out there and join the world and be part of this and all that. Sorry, what were you going to say, though? We cut you off, too.
I don't know, just that he's up front. In That Hideous Strength, he tells us that this is a tall tale, he says, but it has a serious point. And the point is a point I've made in The Abolition of Men. So he says that. So I think we forgive him. It's not a lecture disguised as fiction. It's a lecture in the form of fiction. Hmm. And that's a completely different thing.
And, so it's like, you know,
movies do it most loudly these days, you know, where they're just going to preach to you for an hour and a half.
Right.
They trick us, or they think they are, or they, because here's what it does. A story, we know who to agree with. And this happens all the time. In a given story, I can agree with, we could have a fictional story of John Wilkes Booth shooting Abraham Lincoln, where John Wilkes Booth was the hero, and we would be totally on his side and see him as a hero, because that's what fiction does. It creates heroes, it frames where things work. So you could do that. That doesn't mean I really think the real John Wilkes Booth is really a hero, but I do feel, appropriately and rightly, that John Wilkes Booth in this story is a hero. Mm-hmm. People get confused then, and they go out of the fiction and still think the actual real person is a hero, and that's how that's how we propagandize people.
Or they see something
by not making clear the difference.
Or they see something in fiction being something in real life being represented in fiction in an inaccurate way, and they think the point of the fiction is to say that's how it should be in real life. And you know what I mean? So they don't have the distinguishment. Yeah. So that's the other thing. I was talking to Kieran and Tia just recently about Christian movies. And Tia was saying Christian movies, like the actual Christian movie industry, never actually shows sin. They never actually show how like ugly and horrible your life can become. It's like this, oh, he might cheat on his wife, but he doesn't. Don't worry, it's fine. And it's kind of like, okay, but what happens if he does? Like that's... I do think grace doesn't extend beyond that point. And I think especially, Till We Have Faces is like, I understand why you didn't read it to us as children. Not just because it's kind of heady and you don't fully understand it, but just because it's like, that's kind of intense. There's some kind of intense things happening in it that that don't exist in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe or Voyage of the Dawn Treader or whatever. So I just think like he's, and so I guess this is why the Dead Poet Society to me shows more, has more spiritual power, I guess we'll say. Well, let's not find a different word. Actual like symbolism, but not just the symbolism, but actual weight and actual gravity than God's Not Dead or Fireproof does. Because those started out with, here's the point, here's the sermon, here's the lesson, let's see if we can figure out a way to fit characters in here. Whereas Dead Poet Society was, here are these characters, that are falling apart, that are broken, that are being misled, that are or being led in the right direction but misconstruing the direction. You know what I mean? And
yes.
So you, and because it shows the actual the full extent of how ugly their sin is, it affects you so much stronger than just a hint at, oh yeah, some people might do bad things at some point.
Because especially perhaps when it's the main character.
Right.
And it's the main character in...
Mm-hmm.
And is she a bad person or a good person? And I think that's maybe the starting place of what we don't understand about this novel. Because I don't know the answer to that question.
Liv, what do you think?
Well, one of the first questions I had was, is Psyche perfect? Is she like the, you know, is she... is she portrayed as like the... You know, first of all, I would see C.S. Lewis. I'm like, is she the Christ figure? Is she like the one that saves everyone and like brings Orwell to understand love in the world and all these things?
Okay. So let's just stop there for a second.
Okay.
Is she the one to bring Orwell to understanding and perfect whatever? No, I don't think that. Okay. Sorry. I guess there's sometimes like there's the Christ figure and they're here to save, but sometimes they're not necessarily here to save the entire world or that's this specific character that they're supposed to make a sacrifice for or whatever. And so I think in the book is set up where the two of them are kind of the ones that are creating the main meat of the world.
Yeah.
So it would make sense for Psyche to be the sacrifice for Orwell.
Yeah.
For her to be changed and reformed and redeemed by it.
Right.
But
that's not really the case. That doesn't seem
to be the case. Sorry.
Which is like, so I guess that was my first thing was like,
is Psyche perfect? Or is she supposed to be symbolic of the Christ figure?
Or just like, what is her, I guess in a storytelling, like in the structure sense, what is her role? Like, I don't quite understand what her role is. Is it, you know?
Yeah.
Is it just so Orwell has a different perspective? I mean, it's also like, she's almost like a, what's the word? Not a prop, but like a
Psyche?
Orwell understanding, because a lot of Orwell's, what's the word? I can't think. Comes between her and Psyche, like all the things that she realizes is because of how she realizes how she treats Psyche and things like that.
Right.
Does that kind of make sense? Or am I saying that right?
I think that makes sense. Yeah. So, I think. You go first, Dave.
Well, I guess my question is, what are the other things that we don't understand? Because
just get all the questions out on the table right away.
Maybe, because I think they might dovetail.
So, because then you also asked, is Orwell a good guy or a bad guy?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's kind of an interesting thing. As I was reading it again, because it's C.S. Lewis, like you were saying, I kept waiting for this moment of like, oh, that's brilliant. That's such a good way of putting it. You know, that all his other books, I've had that moment of like, in Perelandra, it's when he makes the realization. Spoilers for all C.S. Lewis, I guess. We're just gonna talk about it all. When he makes the realization of that he needs to kill Wesley.
Weston. Yeah.
That moment, I was like, this is such a brilliant moment. This is such a cool story. Especially coming out of the Silent Planet, which I think is a really cool, fun science fiction fantasy novel about, you know, going to Mars and whatnot. Whereas Perelandra is almost entirely this like internal dialogue of why exactly am I here and what am I supposed to do? And she's here, but I don't really understand what her deal is. And now he's here all of a sudden. I don't know what that's about. You know what I mean? And so it's really interesting that when he gets to that moment, it's this like, oh, cool. Let's keep going. What's going to happen next? The Great Divorce was a little bit different because it's kind of like, I really loved like all the different, just overhearing those kind of that conversation and seeing what they're doing over there. And it's all these little vignettes of like really, really, again, he's taking this concept of here's this thing that exists in Christian theology and let's create characters having a conversation about it. And here's a different concept. Let's create new characters having a conversation about that. And that's, I think, what The Great Divorce was. So I kept waiting for something like that to happen until We Have Faces, and it never really did. And I got to a point where I kind of stopped expecting it. And then I think I really started to just I don't know.
Well, I think Orwell is a good is. I feel like she's always searching to do the right thing, but she struggles with herself. In
she
her,
struggles
like,
with is she doing it her for, own motives for the actual good or yeah. for?
So she's kind of so I think
right.
She's a good wanting right. to do good, but she
and
fails.
I feel
a
like
lot,
she
but.
Repeatedly figures out. I'm being selfish. I'm being bitter. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually taking into consideration anyone else, and continually goes against that realization. You know what I mean?
But you do see times mm-hmm. where she's like pretty bitter and like angry right. with things. Yeah, she's not. Yeah.
So what other questions do we have about the book? Do you have any other specifics, Dave?
Well, I guess I would say it's for me, there are a series of things that are being struggled with. Mostly it's Orwell. Is that how we're saying it? Orwell?
Okay. You can say it.
Struggling with basically what is reality.
Right.
And so we have a bunch of different things going on. We have the king leading through what we might call common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the priest who, at least as we're first told about him, if I remember, it's more like he's sort of a going through the motions.
Right.
Yeah.
Religious power guy.
Yeah.
And then there's the captain of the guard, right? Is that what he is? The
yeah.
Bardia?
Bardia.
Who is, you know, and he reminds me of the fellow, I can't remember his name, in the last battle, the sincere worshiper of Tash, you know,
I remember.
Emmett. Anyway, okay. It's a similar character. Lewis does that a lot. He has a mm-hmm. certain number of characters that he repeats many of these mm-hmm. characters in his stories, related to each other. So you have Bardia, who is this sincere believer, mm-hmm. a devoted, you know, guy.
But he's also very much like, as long as I don't mess with them, they won't mess with me kind of thing.
Yes.
So it's
yes,
not like
because
he's truly... Sorry, keep going. Yeah.
Well, but he's been taught that, and he's right. been taught a series of superstitions. Don't use an iron knife on fruit. Right. I don't remember what the specific right. things are. But things that we would call superstition... until we notice what the Old Testament says we can and can't do, which explain the difference between superstition and mm-hmm. that the priest's robe has to have pomegranate tassels. Mm-hmm. Why is that important? I don't know how to answer a lot of those questions. So, and then there's the fox, the grandfather, the Greek teacher. And so he's Greek wisdom. And here's the fundamental question. What was Orwell to do?
At
what
point?
Should she have believed was true? Up until the point where the God revealed himself to her, we didn't, because we knew things from her standpoint. What did we think was true at that point?
Well, that's the thing.
Had Psyche been killed? Was right. this monster a rotten human being? Was it a
right.
horrible
moment,
beast?
At the moment when... Psyche realizes that she can't see the palace. Then I was like, the question was, okay, so who's right? And at correct. First, part of me was like, well, I think Psyche's right because she's now been sacrificed to a god and is now married to a god. So,
and it you would make you believed sense that for her. You believed that Psyche had
up
actually
to that
been
point,
married to
right,
a god.
Up to that point,
did you,
I believe,
Olivia?
I think so. I will say, like, up until in the book so far before that, everything mentioned about the gods, I didn't believe, like the House of
right.
Get or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit like, is this a different dimension? Like, is this a different right. world? Is this House of Unget real then? If these and gods are real, or is it this fake and this real? I was a little bit confused.
What was, do you remember what the Greek name for Unget was? Was it was
Aphrodite?
She okay, so she was basically
Venus,
just a fictional...
the god of love.
Right.
Yeah.
A fictional name for
well,
that.
Yes, Ungud is, as far as I know,
kind of a separate mythology with the Kingdom of Glum that reinterpreted,
he copied. The Greek and, yes, yes, right. That's what he did. He took existing mythology and made it sound like it might sound in the separate kingdom. Right. Yes.
Where was I going with that? Well, no, yeah. So I guess I thought that she was actually married to a god, and it would make sense that now that she's married to a god, she has now inherited divine powers. So, and her sister hasn't.
So you believe that C.S. Lewis is writing a novel about other gods?
Well, in a tiny little bit of research I did about the book itself, he read the story of Psyche and Cupid and was dissatisfied with it, so he rewrote it to make more sense. Is the brief, like, Wikipedia summary that I read. Where I was like, sure, I don't know. I mean, so I guess that's part of it that I think we keep coming back to is like we want this like grand C.S. Lewis where he has like these brilliant theological ideas that he's presenting through these fictional characters and all that. And I don't know if that was the case. I mean, he started working on it before he was a Christian. He started working on it when he was primarily a poet and not an essay writer or fiction writer. And so I think to me, that's like that is really intriguing, and it wasn't published, I don't think, until 1956 or something. So he was already, you know, he was an established Christian author at that point.
Right.
So yes, I.
So you
I guess
believe
here's
that.
Here's the thing, if Psyche was truly brought to the tree, and was just died there, and there are no gods or anything, and this mythology is entirely fake, why would Orwell suddenly imagine finding her and Bardia together going and finding this valley on the other side of the mountain and the stream, and they both see Psyche, and she goes across and she talks to Psyche, and she, you know, what is the point where she would start imagining these things, and what is the point where then Bardia would begin imagining at least part of it with her? You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's why I think at least part of it is true. And I think the actual, everything up until the valley being destroyed, I think is happening as Psyche is saying. And I think after that, because we, at that point, we only follow Orwell and we only hear her perspective. That's, I think,
so
where,
why can't Orwell see the palace?
I guess a way is she has not inherited any divine powers to see the palace. I think in the same way Psyche talks about feeling ashamed by being around these invisible beings, not just because she's mortal, just because she's so much less than they. And I think she feels that way because she, her entire life, has been truly compassionate and emotional and understanding, and Orwell hasn't in the same way. It talks about when Psyche is born and the king kills the page boy, and it doesn't really say, Orwell's reaction isn't really like, oh, that's horrific. It's just kind of like, oh, he killed the boy, and then she kind of just moves on with it. So in a way, I think she has grown kind of immune to her own kingdom, and she's very, doesn't really like it and stuff. And kind of the only thing that she has, she doesn't really have anything that great until Psyche. And now all of a sudden she loves Psyche so much. And that's kind of all she's focusing on, is just Psyche. And then the fox too is, you know, sorry, what were you gonna say?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Well, no, let me ask this question. This is a novel, not a work of theology. And yet
it may be remembered wrong. That was bad.
It is a novel about someone dealing with, wrestling with questions of the fundamental reality of religious thought. And bearing extraordinarily immense consequences because she had the wrong opinion about that religious thought, and or because she, her heart, you know, to what extent was she led by resentment and envy and things like that. But even so, she's paying a really high price. A lot of us have a lot of resentment and envy. We don't pay the price she had to pay, or Psyche. So what do you think? Put it in Christian terms, what's going on? We don't, you mentioned all the Sunday school movies or the Christian movies or whatever, where everything is simplified. And so we believe in one God. Let's go with it. If this were a Christian movie, how would we make sense of this?
I think the valley being destroyed and Psyche being exiled is Lot's wife looking and seeing Sodom and Gomorrah being burned.
Wow.
She was told not to by the gods and did.
And she did.
And she faced consequences for it. Psyche's story from where she's first introduced in the book up until the valley being destroyed. To me, that whole story makes sense. I see not just logic, but like spiritual truths being exemplified throughout it. She is compassionate. She sees people have faith in her, so she feels compelled to
Psyche.
Yes. People say she can heal us, so she believes maybe I can. I'm at least going to try. I'm at least going to spend time with these people and express compassion towards them.
I feel
them.
Like we don't get to see them her make that decision, though. Really. Like, well, we don't see
them. Yes, you're right.
At all. Like, really? It's hard for me to, like, even relate to, like, what she's doing because I don't, or not relate, but just understand.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, but that, maybe that doesn't
part of that
effect.
Is because it's being narrated from the perspective of Orwell, who...
Yeah, anyway, no, yeah, but I'm just saying... Yeah, sorry.
She expresses compassion towards people, and when they say she's the cursed one, she's the reason that this is, that all these bad things are happening to us, we need to sacrifice her to the gods, she's willing to do that. She's offering herself as a living sacrifice.
She doesn't offer herself, does she?
She agrees. She agrees with everyone else saying you need to go. You need to be offered as a sacrifice.
I didn't think she did that. She is resigned to it. They say, I mean, it's the king with soldiers with swords saying you're going to go be sacrificed.
Really see,
and so she is at peace with that. But I don't think she's not going willingly.
And
she's going against her will, but peacefully.
We see the conversation between Orwell the fox, the priest, and the king about it. And they're in disagreement about it. And they're the ones that have the discussion. And then the first time we see Psyche after the decision has been made, she's already in the cell, in the room with five walls.
But even there, she's not like freaking out or anything. Like,
no,
she's
so
decided,
she is,
like,
she is resigned with it. Yes, so it's, but...
But, she seems to see something greater. I feel like she's always like looking
this
with
is
like
really interesting.
Yes.
I didn't think about this
like
until
light
now.
Or,
she's not. I don't think she says anything about. And then the rains will come back, and the disease will go away, and the cattle will live again. She's not doing it for the gods. She's doing it because she wants to experience more beauty, and she believes the gods can give that to her.
I don't think that's. I don't think she says that. I think
she says,
does it because the men with swords are going to take her there whether she wants to or not. So she is at peace with it, and now she is. I think after the fact she sees, when she's talking with Orwell after the fact,
no, but
she
says
sees
before,
the good that has come of it.
But before she goes, she says, deep down I've always wanted to die. Something to the effect of that when I
that's right.
When I'm at my happiest and experiencing the most love and beauty, I want to experience more far from the mountain over there and all that.
Isn't there something when she's retelling to Orwell later that when she was like they gave her like, you know, sleeping medicine.
Right.
And then she's
yes.
like up on the tree and she like starts to be a little bit frightened. Like she didn't necessarily, but maybe it was because she didn't know what was gonna happen.
Yes. So she is not She's not completely manipulated into it, and she's not completely of her own accord doing it.
I don't think she knows exactly that the god, like what's going to happen.
And so I guess that's the thing is, she doesn't really mention anything about the god's will until they meet again in the valley.
Yeah.
So I didn't
after
think of that
she has actually
now.
Met the actual god, and so that's what we have. That's the first report in the book about an actual encounter with an actual god. So this strikes me. And I looked at this differently when I was 23 or 4 the first time I read it, and when I was, I don't know, 34 or 40 the second time I read it. And now, which I haven't read it since then, so I may misremember a lot. But
you haven't read it in 60 years?
I haven't.
I made an old man joke.
I get it. The conversation between the king and the priest and the fox and Orwell beforehand, it's to a really me, good
conversation.
It is really good. And it so. To me, it in this conversation, I'm beginning to see more symbolic and allegorical things. And I see in that moment a conversation between, we forget that our religion is centered in killing cows. I mean, that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. For generations and generations, the central act of worship was killing things. So when she describes, I remember the first time my hackles went up. She's describing, you know, sacrifice, and she's talking mm-hmm. about the smell of blood and stuff like that yeah. came with the priest. I think we are lost. It's lost on us how gross religion was. Mm-hmm. And how dark and how hard and how harsh. And the idea of you know, slides with worship songs with pictures of alpine meadows and butterflies, mm-hmm. that does not fit a place that is centered on killing cows mm-hmm. and burning them. It just absolutely is not the same thing. So there's a harsh reality at the core that priest was involved in. And at that moment, we see the priest really believing that what he's saying is real and true. The fox, with his Greek wisdom, doesn't believe a word of it. And in my mind, it struck me. He represents the Christian church. Doesn't believe a word of there being gods. That's Christianity. Mm. It's a philosophy. It's a philosophical belief that is not connected to reality. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying Christianity as 90%, 80%, mm-hmm. 22%, I don't know what, a large percentage of people experience Christianity. He is exactly what it is. The thought that you're going to go there and experience God in that way that Psyche does, you can experience God, but you can experience God in the Bible or in communion or, you know, mm-hmm. we have Bible studies, maybe, and we'll hold hands and sing.
That's the way the but fox we're going is to take, saying you experience God.
Yes, the fox is saying, I mean, he's not for singing and holding hands, but he's absolutely the actual real God. You know, he's behind our songs. That's what mm-hmm. Christians believe. But we could pull an actual real God out of Christianity. It wouldn't change a single thing. Nothing. Zero would be changed. The philosophy of Christianity would not change, which is, I think, 90% of Christians would not change one whit if actual God was removed. Mm. And so what we see is Psyche. Psyche is another word for the soul. Mm-hmm. The soul goes up and is transfigured on a mountaintop mm-hmm. and is married to the son of the goddess of love. In other words, he's married to the son of God, he's married to love. Mm-hmm. I mean, Psyche, in one sense, is the bride of Christ. Mm-hmm. And she has an actual encounter with actual God. And we forget.
No one believes her.
Because we forget, because Christianity is so much a philosophy, we forget how terrifying real mm-hmm. God is.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So, because that's the thing, is that she says, and this is pretty late in the book, where she says she's been kind of caught between the culture of Glum and the teaching of the fox, between the culture of the House of Unget and...
Psyche says that.
I think Orwell reiterates it later. I don't remember if Psyche says it. But yeah, I think there's a moment, I think after she's become queen, or maybe it's right before, anyway... Or she's talking about that, and I think that's I think so many people become Christian and absolutely don't understand I've talked a little bit about this where it's a longer conversation we'll get into later on.
I feel like this might go up down a little bit of a drought trail.
But it's just the thing where, you know, the Old Testament is covering how many thousand years? 5,000 some?
From the first human being.
So. Right. And the New Testament covers...
how you do that math.
Right. And the New Testament is a century-ish?
Less than, but yeah.
So, you know what I mean? And there are, the New Testament's a little bit shorter as far as like verses and, or pages and, or whatnot. Yeah. But you know what I mean? It's a thing where it's so much higher resolution, as Jordan Peterson would put it, right? You actually are seeing letters written from people, conversations. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's much more chronicled because it's just more recent. They're able to fit in, you know, here are four guys who are actually there with Jesus and here are all of their reports on what happened, as opposed to Moses saying, oh yeah, like 2,000 years ago this thing happened and we found out about it and we, you know, shared these stories for these thousands and thousands of years. You know what I mean? It's so sorry. I say all that to say, yes, I think you're right. Psyche, I feel like I actually know her. I feel like I actually understand her character and her motivation and who she is.
I don't feel that way. The
priest, really?
No.
Really? Say more.
You're
stuck between two Driscolls, Livy.
So. Yeah. Good luck to me.
You got to fight to get your words in.
So, the question is, why do I not understand why Psyche makes these certain decisions?
Right.
I don't... Maybe it's just because we follow Orwell's character and we go deep into, like, every single thing of what she says and does is, like, narrated for us, in a sense. So maybe it's partly that. I feel like Psyche is a faraway character in my mind. Like, I know that she's a big part of it.
Yes.
But I can't quite... It's like, oh, she decides to, you know, do this. And I'm like, maybe it's just I don't have an emotional attachment to her as much or something. What it related to, why did you say that?
I think you're right.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's I feel like I understand her in one way. I understand the basics of what she is and the basics of her heart.
Yeah. But
you're exactly right. I don't understand the details of her as a human being anywhere near as much as I do. I mean, I feel like I understand Barty as a person.
Yes.
In detail, almost more than Psyche. Because we see more of him, really. Mm-hmm. And certainly Orwell.
It's interesting.
And you don't really see Psyche fail at things until she, like, turns a lamp on or whatever. And then we see, oh, that was not, she wasn't supposed to do that. And then she gets exiled and stuff. But you don't see her really make mistakes, I don't think. Do you? As much as, like, Orwell doesn't necessarily, like, you just see her,
She seems naive. Like I said, I think, you know, the people say she can heal us, and she doesn't really know. She has no, you know, she has no reason to believe that she can heal them, but she goes, sure, I guess.
But she has no reason to believe she can't.
Right.
And so, and again, from a perspective of 2022, it's obvious that the burden of proof, the double, triple, quadruple burden of proof, if you can heal, you have to double prove it, triple prove it, quadruple prove it. That's not what the biblical record.
No.
The biblical record is prove that he can't heal. Why wouldn't you be able to heal? Duh. Of course you can heal. And it's our Greek wisdom. It's because we're a philosophy that we have changed that burden of proof.
Do you think the fox is, do you like any, do you agree with anything that he's saying?
Most of it. I mean, it's like they say, most of what he says is true. Or Psyche finds the peace she has on the night of the execution. Precisely because of the Greek wisdom. It's so the Greek wisdom we're taught in our Christian churches is valuable philosophy as far as it goes.
But
it doesn't
prepare
us for reality. It's just disconnected from... And again, if your reality happens to go along certain paths, then it's perfectly... It's a perfectly competent reality. As long as you don't have droughts like the kingdom ran into, and as long as you don't have... You know, the need to sacrifice someone to the gods, or you don't have an encounter with any real god, then that philosophy is perfectly adequate.
Because I think when I first read it, I was really intrigued. Yeah, when the fox came and I was like, oh, a breath, like a, it's a new outlook of things. And I kind of almost thought of him as the, you know, this is a really interesting to hear you talk about the other side of it, because I thought of him as more of the person bringing in the new truth. Of sorts to the world.
Yes, I did too.
Well, so that's the thing. I feel
finish.
Like
it's, sorry, Lev.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, that was it. I mean, I don't know.
I think it's kind of laid out in the inverse of how the formula typically goes with what I thought these kinds of stories were. I thought it would start out kind of where it ended in this kind of stagnant, you know, the structure of a comedy is what I was picturing. The stagnant community with a failing religion and gods that are unknown and unknowable and people that are just apathetically blindly going along with it. And then, yeah, the fox comes in and starts teaching the princess something. And then Psyche is born and she embodies those teachings. And she's the one that is then, you know, in a quote unquote perfectly Christian symbolic story, she would symbolically, you know, be the cursed one, take on all the sins of the entire culture and say, I'm going to do away with this religion that is failing and you will be fruitful and whatnot. But that happens like six chapters in is the sacrifice, you know? And that's, right. I guess I was so shocked. Like, oh wait, it's just happened. It's just done now. And I was like, what's the rest of the book going to be? And I feel like that kind of, and that's the thing again, up till the valley being destroyed, that feels like a very cohesive story and you're naturally following along and seeing where it's going. After that, I guess this is where the testament of just like how well it's written. The stories that happen after that don't really tie into what that was about. There are still a lot of mentions that she has internal dialogue of her being angry with the gods, but her restructuring the kingdom and her fighting in battles and her becoming, you know, killing the prince and becoming allies with Fars and those kinds of things, those aren't in direct relation to the concepts that are being explored with the sacrifice of Psyche. Those are just now the
it's kind of a really setup.
It's incredibly well written, and it's a great story of this queen finding, you know, rejuvenating her kingdom. That's, I think it's very cool, and there's some really, really great moments that happen in there. But it just, again, because it's Lewis, I keep thinking he's just such a precise and, I guess, cohesive writer that this seems very different. I guess in Out of the Silent Planet, in Prince Caspian, in the last battle, there's the last few chapters where it's like the main climax has happened, and now all of a sudden, like, this brand new realm is being introduced that we explore for a couple chapters and then it's over, right?
Right.
This is like the climax happens eight chapters in, and then the exploring the brand new realm is the beef of the story. And not as much happens. It's just a very interesting structure that this book is. Sorry, what were you going to say, Liv?
Was I going to say something?
Yeah, you interrupted me.
I don't remember. Okay. Sorry.
So I think that's a really interesting take on it, Aiden, and I hadn't quite seen it that way. I think again, what it gets at, and I'm going to sound a little like I have an axe to grind here, which I don't mean to. It's just I'm in thinking about it since you called yesterday, or texted about talking about it. I mean, I haven't thought much about it for a while, so I began to see things differently, or additionally. And she came to an actual revelation of an actual god.
Psyche.
How many people have it? Yes. No. Orwell. There are two people in the book that have an actual revelation of the actual god, Psyche and Orwell. Right.
Right.
She actually saw him. And he actually spoke and said, you two are Psyche, or whatever he said, something to that effect, right? And what does that mean?
Right.
What do I do with that? And I think even Christianity, salvation comes. Okay, we're done. That's the climax. And if you're four when it comes, or 12, or 20, what do you do with the rest of your life?
Right.
And you know, the answer we give is, oh, just walk around being moral or holy or righteous or something like that. but there's no particular reason, because the whole salvation thing is done with, as if salvation's the point.
Right.
We talk as if salvation's the point. Are you going to die? When you die, you're going to go to heaven. That's the whole point. And it's not that the Bible does not give that sense, and the book doesn't either.
Okay.
What has been revealed to her is the reality that underlies Ungot is a real thing. The priest is wrong about a lot of what that means. Can you really use an iron knife on your apple or whatever Bardia thinks you can or can't do? Things have grown up and they step over the lines. They turn into superstitions. They're empty, many of them. But that doesn't mean they didn't stem from some actual and real encounter with something actual and real. The fox moves it and it's just ideas and talks and philosophies on the same subject, but it's also removed from reality. Orwell has had this actual experience. She's the only one who's encountered reality, except Psyche, who we don't see hardly at all after the first little bit. And what does that mean? How does that play out in her life?
Well, and I think here's something that's really interesting is Psyche says, I've had this encounter with the gods, and Orwell's final decision is to not believe her or to challenge her on that. Orwell has this interaction with the gods, and her decision is, I'm not going to tell anyone about this. And she doesn't tell anyone about it.
Right.
She tells the fox about her initial interaction with Psyche and leaves a lot of the significant things out about the second interaction with Psyche.
Right.
But then she still has encounters and doesn't tell anyone about it. So it's not the typical story of like her talking to other people and other people say, what? You're crazy. And her thinking, oh, I must be crazy or maybe I'm not. It's not that typical thing. It's just her purely within her own head. And a lot of it is her believing the gods are real and I hate them and I'm bitter with them and I'm angry with them. Okay, so what the god says, you two are Psyche. And then later on, I don't remember if this is told to her or she assumes it, that she is Unget for the last little bit.
Sorry.
You have something to say on that?
Yeah, what's that
about?
Liv?
I was looking at a little bit of a summary earlier.
She cheated.
I didn't cheat. I just refreshed. And, okay. This is their paraphrasing, so just tell me if it's wrong.
Who's this they?
The internet. Okay. Says that she has a dream that her father forces her to look in a mirror without her veil, and then she sees that her face is out of Unget. Right. And then that night she goes to the river intending to drown herself, but a god's voice tells her not to jump because she must, this is a quote, die before she dies. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? That's kind of weird. But that just made me think of, like, that's where she thought that she saw Unget. And what does that mean?
The dream that she had where her father showed her that she was Unget.
And then she didn't like that, apparently.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't like that she's Unget because Unget took her sister and Unget is the reason that, I mean, I think that's one thing that I think that's a very surface of it. She just doesn't like Unget because she, Orwell's endured all this suffering because of Unget. And
she blames it on
her. She blames it on her. So if she is now becoming Unget, she wants to destroy that part of Unget.
So what does it mean that she must die before she dies? What does that mean?
I didn't remember that part. In a way, I think it's, from a Christian perspective, you can't choose your time. You can't, you shouldn't. You shouldn't try and take that power into your own hands. You should leave that up to God.
Well, sure, but the actual, like.
What? The actual, you must die before you die, the way that that's
what
phrased?
What is that? Die to what before you die to what? Oh.
Glad I could help.
What?
Well, is it die as in let go of like certain beliefs before she
like rebirth as Christians. Yeah.
Her supposedly all her life is all spent now because of her love for Psyche, right?
Right.
But it's a pretty ugly. I mean, Psyche says something like, I don't remember the wording, but something like, it's hard to tell your love from hate.
Right.
What's the difference between love and hate? And there isn't much.
Right.
And like Unget, Orwell is a devouring mother. She's a, you know, she eats the things she loves.
Right. And as it goes, that's kind of continually explored. And I mean, that's described about the, what do they call him before they, the, not the beast, the, what do they refer to as Unget's son? Anyway.
The shadow beast?
Something like, I don't remember.
Yeah, that's something like that.
But yeah, I mean, they talk about that, how if if he loves her and takes her as his wife, this is how it'll go. And if he devours her and destroys her, this is how it'll go. And they're pretty similar. And so, like, well, what's kind of what's kind of the difference? So at the very end, let's jump to that. When she's talking, when she has the vision of being in the desert and the bird leading her to the council and her reading from the scroll,
that's when she thinks it's what she has written, but it's not what she's written?
Correct.
Is that the scroll?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What's the deal with that? That was a point. I do want to say I'm pretty proud of this. This is pretty early on in the book. I was thinking through, like, I wonder why it's called Till We Have Faces. And got to a point in the book, I think this was right after she came back from the valley the first time and told the fox all about it. And she is talking to, and she was saying, we can rescue her from there and we can hide her at Bardia's place. And the fox says, well, we can't because his wife would never allow that. And she talks about how, what a horrible wife Bardia must have. And I was like, I wonder if Till We Have, just the title Till We Have Faces has something to do with, she doesn't know the Bardia's wife. So Bardia's wife doesn't have a face. So she just hears these stories and goes, oh, what a horrible person. She doesn't know the gods. They don't have faces. And she just hears these things and goes, ah, what horrible people.
Wow.
And so I'm like, I think Till We Have Faces is basically like, you can't know anyone till we have faces.
Yeah, you told me that too.
I told you that. At the very end, it's phrased, how can we meet face to face till we have faces? And I was like, I basically called that. I basically figured it out.
Which,
like, 10 chapters in. I was pretty proud of myself for figuring out what the point of the C.S. Lewis title was. Before it was over. That hideous strength, I didn't get until like the end, and I was like, that's that hideous strength. That's what you're talking about. Sorry. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, that. You know, we shall meet him face to face, Paul says, right? And so we have to have a face to do that. We have to grow into our faces. And is that part of our, I don't know, Liv, is that part of the death that. That she has to go through. I don't know. That's probably stretching, but I don't know. There's a lot. Here's what I think it doesn't do. The book doesn't, unlike Lewis's other books, this book doesn't have any answers to our questions, except what we see people experience, which doesn't necessarily answer a lot of our questions, but it certainly brings questions up. Have we gotten to all of your Liv, you said there are things you don't understand. Have we gotten to? Or what have we not gotten to?
I mean, at the end of the book, we see that... I mean, I'm trying to remember everything. But we see her come to a resolution about everything, right? Like, she's not in...
In a sense.
Like, she's like, okay, this was... I don't know. We spent so much of it, of the book, she's trying to figure things out. And to me, that's like, do we... So... What and is she so trying
I
guess to figure?
I didn't finish it and feel like she had reached a resolution. I think she had reached a resolution in certain areas. I think she'd reached a resolution that... I guess, okay, the most resolution that I saw was her admitting what she perceives as reality is reality, which is the gods are real, the gods have been doing these things, Psyche's been wandering for years and years and years. Psyche's doing these things out of love for the god. And to me, that was the most resolution that she herself came to.
I guess I mean more in herself, not like factually what's happening in the world.
She has a resolution about where she is?
Yeah.
And I guess I didn't really see a super strong... And do again, you live? I think... I think she had many throughout the book... realizations of, yeah, like you said, Psyche saying, I don't know your love from your hate, and her realizing that and going, oh wow, am I being selfish, am I being bitter, what's this all about, but then acting out against those realizations. Sorry, what are you saying?
I think she has a better I would say she has a better understanding of certain things of why she acted whatever when she was younger to, you know, we see a lot of extremes happen when it was younger, but then, cause right. it's split into two parts kind of, right? The book. Mm-hmm.
But the second part's only the last like five chapters or something, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm not sure.
What do you think, Dave? Does it come to a resolution?
No.
I mean, I guess you did just say that it doesn't answer our questions, really.
Because
it comes to this, though, I think. It again, we are so steeped, we can't believe how deeply we are Greek in our mm-hmm. philosophy. Mm. We are deeply Greek, and we have rejected the Hebrew religion that Christianity grew out of, and we mm-hmm. have rejected it, and because that religion is centered in reality and not ideas. Mm-hmm. And we are centered in ideas. And so our resolution has to be one of ideas. How does this make sense? How does this become understood in a logically consistent way? And I don't get there with till we have faces. And of course, for me, who I don't think Christianity is a philosophy. There's a real God on top of the mountain, and there are some beautiful things about him, and there are terrifying things about him, and there are just mostly a whole lot of clouds and thick darkness surrounding him. The Bible says that like 80 times or maybe 100 times or, you know, I don't know, a ton of times, mm-hmm. things like that. And we think that means that we can understand every last thing about him. And so we expect our stories to enable us to see every last thing. And that's the resolution we expect is a philosophically, logically consistent resolution.
And that's why
I think there is, like psyche, there's peace. I think Orwell finds a degree of peace at the end because she's accepted? I don't know if that's the right word. That's too strong a word. The gods are real. There's real stuff going on. The gods aren't there for the purpose of doing philosophically understandable things. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get messed up, is we expect the one God to sit around doing philosophically understandable things. And even if he is philosophically consistent, we don't have the capability of having a philosophy that can understand that consistency. And so I'm speaking here actually at the center of Christian orthodoxy, but it sounds radical in the 21st century to say that if you can explain this a truth about God, it can't be fully true.
Well, that's why it describes Ungud as having no face, which means she has 1,000 faces.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I think that's ding, it, ding, ding. Is that the priests in Till We Have Faces have an understanding of the gods. Orwell has a slightly different understanding of the gods. The fox has a different understanding of the gods. And I guess at the end of the book, I look at what the priests did and I go, they didn't really do anything that they didn't do really anything that was proven to be that just or moral or beneficial.
Right.
But same with Orwell, same with the fox. And so I guess that's the thing. I feel like this book is incredibly, like Liv, you talked about it being a tragedy, and I think it is, but it's also incredibly ironic. So I don't know if that would be a tragic irony or an ironic tragedy, but I just feel like, it ends and it is this very, because even like a true and true tragedy ends and you feel like compassion and sympathy for what's going on. And this book ended and I just wasn't sure. I was like, I feel compassion for her in these moments, right after Bardia dies and she's talking to her wife. I feel compassion for her there. Mm. I don't really feel compassion for her when she's having this dream about her father in, you know, you down don't. in the cellar of the pillar room. I don't.
Do you have?
I guess maybe. I think. I mean, yeah. I think I immediately started reading and just, even though I can't pick out connections specifically personality-wise that I'm similar to her, I felt like I was her while walking through the book. Too. So I guess
Mm-hmm. Me too.
With whatever time that she was upset or something, I was like, oh, I feel that like that was what came over me. Interesting. So I didn't see it as an outside person watching her go through whatever.
You could see that she was wrong about this or wrong about that.
Yeah.
But more in the way that I would see that I'm wrong about this or wrong about that. I might know it. That doesn't mean I'm not doing it
but
anymore.
But you could
just
because
I know.
Yeah.
You understood how she got to those conclusions.
Well, most of the time she would understand that she did something wrong in the next chapter or something.
I'm not sure. Dave, what are your final thoughts?
Well, if these are final thoughts, because my battery's a little on the low, it's almost out. So, and I can plug it in, but then I lose the headphones. And it is, really. So you have a lot of editing to do.
This will be a good time.
I think, my final thing is that it's worth rereading. Oh, Hellos are worth re-listening to, et cetera. And I think some of the greatest stuff is the stuff that you don't understand. I don't understand some Sylvia Plath poetry. I don't understand Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, and I think it's because I think at root there are the questions that we're wrestling with have to do with if we don't see God, mm-hmm. all we have are ideas about God to deal with. And we either base our ideas on our ideas or we base our ideas on someone else's experience or on logic. We can base our ideas on lots of different things. Or on convenience, or what is successful, but to equate those with actual God, in a way, Orwell pays a higher price, kind of the to whom much is given, much is expected philosophy. She knew and loved Psyche, and destroyed her, in a certain sense, to a certain extent. She experienced the gods, and hard things came of it. I don't know. I think a relationship with God is the fundamental thing on earth and for all time. And I think it's confusing. I think I think that's what the Bible indicates to me. It's confusing. Mm-hmm. It's not simple answers. It's real. It's way better than simple answers, but that doesn't mean it's more fun. For some people it is. For a lot of people it isn't. The guy that reached out to stop the Ark of the Covenant from tipping over, for all we know, he was doing a good thing. He wasn't trying to defy God. He was stopping the Ark of the Covenant from tipping over. But he still got destroyed by it. You don't just touch the Ark of the Covenant and go on with your day, Mm-hmm. So God's a big deal, and I think that's what comes out in this. And I think it's that honest wrestling. Lewis, who was an atheist and then kind of a quasi-romantic, quasi-pagan guy for a little while, he came to Christ precisely because he held only onto what was absolutely real. He was not going to be satisfied with mere philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly why he was such a good writer and such a...
Yes, I agree.
Such a... Well, two things. He absolutely understood the atheist perspective as well because he lives so much of his life in that way. So when he is in Mere Christianity, in the Abolition of Man, in the Screwtape Letters, he's not just, hey, here's how to live virtuously. It's here's how to live virtuously. It's here's the reality. I mean, that's what a lot of it is. And that's kind of what if you brought Till We Have Faces to a Christian studio and said, we should make this into a movie. They'd say, cool, we're going to cut like 80% of it because it's too real, quote unquote, it's actually exploring the sin. Same with parts of The Great Divorce, same with The Screwtape Letters. It's actually exploring the gravity of the realness of it.
Same with the Bible.
Right, but it's
we cut 80% of it.
It's easier to cherry pick the Bible because it's older, so
and big.
Right, it's like copyright. It expires after a certain time where you don't have to care about it as much. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Liv, do you have any closing thoughts?
No.
All right. Well, folks, that's Till We Have Faces. That was a hefty convo. Dave, you have any final thought that could?
It's a great book.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis, there's He varies from extraordinarily good to immortally good. So yeah. That's...
Whoa.
Wow. It's just some light blasphemy here.
And I don't know that I've ever met anyone else who listed it as one of their favorite books, and both of you have. So, I mean, I've never really talked about it with anyone very much because nobody... So it's cool that you've encountered it that way. It's a great book.
It's a good one for sure. Book. I'm rereading the Screwtape Letters now, and I remember that being a lot funnier. But maybe it gets funnier.
Funny. It's the way I read it, Aiden.
Maybe that's it. I remember because I was like eight. I was like eight when you read it, and I didn't understand like all. Like,
I was very funny.
Were you?
I didn't either.
Because I think. Colum and Kieran and Mom, I remember cracking up, and I was like, I don't get it. I don't get the jokes yet. Maybe later on. Anyway, I'm reading it now. There's a lot of moments. I love the one part where he's talking about the game is to get them to run around with fire extinguishers in a flood. I think that is so good. That is so good. Anyway, cool. All right. Well, thanks for listening, folks. All right. Thanks for being on, Dave.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great.
Do you want to say tune back in next week for a brand new episode of...
Tune in next week for a brand new episode of...
Between Takes.
How was that?
Yay.
That was good. That was usable. We can use that. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, cool. Dave.
Thanks. All right.
Have a good night. Love you.
All right. Love you too. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.